with most of the things, you kind of have to break the wall with your own head. But at least you can have, you don't need to do it all the time.
Hello and welcome to Was bringt sie zu mir, der Medizin Podcast. My name is Bianca Etario and this episode is in English because my guest today is Alexander Ćirić. Dr. Alexander Ćirić is the general manager of Novo Nordisk Austria. So he is the leader of a big pharmaceutical company, and he's also a doctor. Herzlich willkommen, Alexander.
Thank you very much, Bianca. It's my pleasure to be here with you today.
It's very unusual, let's say, the perspective of our podcast so far, to have somebody from the industry as a guest. But I find it very important to show the different sides of the healthcare sector and also try to diminish the myth and the prejudices that go for and against the pharmaceutical industry. But first, I always start with what brings your patients to you. So in this case, to the pharmaceutical company. And so I asked what, for our listeners, what is Novo Nordisk all about?
Novo Nordisk is a pharmaceutical company originally from Denmark that exists now 101 years, to be exact. So last year we celebrated 100-year anniversary as a company. And it has been known for most of these 100 years as the diabetes company. So we were the world leader in diabetes, in providing treatments for diabetes. Mainly it used to be insulin for many years. Now we also have new molecules in the last decade. But that was where the company's research and investments and products were made in the most of this century. Recently, we also entered a relatively new area, which is obesity, which is kind of the disease of the future. And this is something that the kind of the two biggest areas where we operate. Now we have also some smaller departments, however, very important products for the treatment of hemophilia and growth hormone and hormone replacement therapy for women in menopause.
Oh, great. All very important areas, let's say, and the company history is closely linked with the discovery of insulin, right? Because that's also about 102 years ago. And now, about your persona, you finished med school in Belgrade, Serbia, and you started to work in a pharmaceutical company when you finished a med student. Did you always want this to be your path ever since you were a med student, or how did you and Novo Nordisk collide?
No, unfortunately or fortunately, this was not planned. I entered medical school with a desire to become a doctor. And this was the plan all along. During my studies, I was quite a good student. I finished in time. It's 6 years in Serbia, so I finished all my exams in time. And as I was getting close to the end, like most of students do, you start to kind of think about the next steps, or you have to start making plans because you want to have a job afterwards. And my kind of idea was that to start working as soon as possible and become independent, start earning
money,
because, you know, as a student, you rely on
parents.
Your parents' help. Mm-hmm. And then medical school lasts a little bit longer than other universities, which usually become independent by the age of 23, 24. We have to do it a little bit later, 25, 26. Mm-hmm. even if you finish on time. So that was kind of my red line, you know, I have to start working for mm-hmm. money. And then what was secondary? Mm-hmm. And however, you know, at this time in Serbia, the options were very limited mm-hmm. to start working for money immediately as a doctor. So mm-hmm. you would have to kind of take a volunteer job mm-hmm. in the hospital mm-hmm. with uncertain outcome mm-hmm. in terms of time. So you could volunteer for 6 months, for a year. Mm-hmm. Some of my friends
like
and colleagues.
Slave.
Yeah. Some of my friends and colleagues would have to do it and did it even for 3-4 years. Wow. If you wanted, for example, let's imagine your dream was to be orthopedic surgeon mm-hmm. and there it was tough to get in. So then you volunteer for 5 years to wait for the spot to open mm-hmm. or, you know, for mm-hmm. things to go your way with a lot mm-hmm. of luck and connections and so on. Mm-hmm. So I said, okay, then this is not for me. Mm-hmm. I'm not willing to wait. So I said, I'll try to find a job in Serbia. Mm-hmm. I gave myself 1 year. Mm-hmm. If not, I would go back to Canada, where I also lived part of my childhood and I had Canadian passport. So mm-hmm. that was mm-hmm. kind of, I could immediately go and start living there and then try to become a doctor there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, then I found a job in Serbia, mm-hmm. but in a pharmaceutical company. Mm-hmm. I started applying on the job ads, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. which I found, mm-hmm. which were mm-hmm. publicly available, and not having a clue what the company is about, what the job is mm-hmm. about. I got into Novo Nordisk in 2007.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So fresh out of med school.
Yeah.
And what did you do there at first?
The job ad was it was called medical sales representative for mm-hmm. growth hormone. So mm-hmm. I was kind of responsible for sales mm-hmm. of growth hormone mm-hmm. For the whole territory of Serbia. Mm-hmm. Clueless completely at the time, like what that job entailed, what mm-hmm. you were supposed to do. But then, you know, a serious organized pharmaceutical company, they have everything organized, you know, induction training, they teach you everything, tell mm-hmm. you, they put you through the program mm-hmm. at the beginning of a couple of months. So you kind of quickly understand what you're supposed to do. And this is not kind of rocket science, at least to start. So mm-hmm.
And then, of course, yeah. you have the background
yeah.
because
yeah.
you had probably endocrinology to base your knowledge on. And yeah, but of course, growth hormone deficiency is a very rare disease everywhere in the world. How many patients were there in Serbia approximately known?
Yeah, there were very few. I remember at the time that I started, about 30 kids were treated with growth hormone in the whole
Serbia.
Yeah, in the whole country, which
okay.
is like a 7 million country, almost mm-hmm. like Austria. So mm-hmm. There was severe undertreatment. Mm-hmm. So, and of course, kids were not diagnosed properly. Mm-hmm. Simply saying, kids were left being short. Mm-hmm. It was kind of their destiny. However, with a lot of work and mm-hmm. also a lot of help from our side and a lot of work of pediatric endocrinologists, we started the program how to discover growth disorders, how mm-hmm. to first catch that the child is behind with weight and mm-hmm. height and stature mm-hmm. and so on, and then they have to go under certain tests, and if deficiency is proven, then they should undergo treatment. That was mm-hmm. the only way for them to catch up and grow. And of course, having a growth disorder, as you know, yeah, it's not only about height. There are a lot of other things that the person will have a problem with as an adult.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And of course, if it's not treated on time, then the window of opportunity yeah. is gone. What would you have set your eyes on? So what direction in the medical specialty would you have chosen? If you wouldn't have entered pharmaceutical industry,
this is
what did you want
yeah,
to be?
Yeah, by actually, this question is very interesting because my answer is one of the reasons why I actually didn't end up in medicine. I didn't know. Mm-hmm. I realized during whole university, passing subject after subject, you know, and going through preclinical, then clinical mm-hmm. subjects. And I realized that I was kind of good at everything, but mm-hmm. nothing especially got my interest that, you know, you fall in love with dermatology or mm-hmm. infectious diseases or mm-hmm. surgery mm-hmm. or whatever. Mm-hmm. Nothing touched my heart mm-hmm. so deep that I would really then, you know, mm-hmm. be ready to even volunteer mm-hmm. or put mm-hmm. additional sacrifice to mm-hmm. get to mm-hmm. that. It was kind of more out of this discipline and being responsible to myself and my parents who financed me mm-hmm. to finish this in time mm-hmm. and get it mm-hmm. over with and then see what I'll do afterwards.
Yeah. And what was your motivation for med school in the first place?
Motivation was also not proper one, I would say. And that was to, as I was always like, good. One of the best or the in best school. Students. It mm-hmm. was in this time, there was this kind of, if you are good, you should do something that's hardest. And the hardest university available was a medical school. So then go where it's hardest, where the mm-hmm. best students are, mm-hmm. where the competition is the best. Mm-hmm. Kind of to use something,
use
some talent that
mm-hmm.
God gave you. So that was more out of this, than
out of a competitive maybe thought, yeah, right?
Exactly.
Okay, so yeah, I find it a bit funny. There are some similarities. I think when I think about me finishing med studies in Romania. There was also this idea, okay, I was on my parents' pocket for 6 years, and the prospect back then, it was in 2008, to enter the working field as a doctor would mean that you would be on a salary of about 200 euros back then a month, so your parents would still have to pay the rent, etc. For me back then, I think it was quite, you would say in German, blauäugig. So I was like, okay, I finished med school. And for me, it was, I would really like to do something in obesity because that caught my heart in med studies. So I thought at the time, well, I would also like to go to Vienna because at that time my boyfriend then was living in Vienna. And I thought, well, who is doing research about obesity in Vienna? And I wrote Thomas Sturnik, who became my PhD supervisor, like, hi, I just finished med studies today and I would like to do some research in obesity. Can I start a PhD? And he was saying, well, PhD calls finished already in the summer, but fortunately I have a free position because one PhD student got pregnant. So that's how I came to Austria. And what about Serbia at that time? How were the salaries for new doctors? So they were not earning anything and they were just volunteering for years.
New doctors would have to volunteer, some not for years, some mm-hmm. maybe, let's say, 6 months mm-hmm. if you were lucky. That was kind of the minimum. Mm-hmm. Up to, I would say, really 4 years if you were not lucky and if really wanted something that was difficult to get, like I mentioned. I don't know, orthopedic surgery or something that was really attractive and that a lot of people wanted, then you would really have to gynecology, mm-hmm. ophthalmology. Mm-hmm. I don't remember. I knew at the time, but, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. like these attractive specialties mm-hmm. Where you were required to wait really, really years without having the salary, which then delays also your specialization.
Yeah, so definitely everything.
Yeah, then you're hired. Let's say you are 25. Uh-huh. When you finish, you wait 3-4 years to get a job. That's like 28, 29. Mm-hmm. Then you get a job. Mm-hmm. Then you wait another 2-3 years to get a place for specialization. And then you start specialization when you're 32-33. So you finish when you're 37. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And actually, you should be already a 10-year experience specialist when you were 37, 40. Yeah.
Did this improve by now or is it still the same?
Yeah, it changed dramatically, especially I would say in the last 5 years, related or not to COVID also, but more related to this lack of physicians mm-hmm. everywhere. And now you get a job immediately,
yeah.
a paid job.
Also,
the salaries are improving.
Yeah.
It's not like it used to be. Also, a lot of options in the private area. Doctors can work in private clinics. Mm-hmm. So now I see, I mean, it's very simple. When I go back and see friends, most of my friends are doctors. Mm-hmm. They are all doing well.
Their standard
of living in Serbia, it's quite high.
Yeah.
And they don't need to go
abroad
anymore. Of course, now it's the opposite thing.
Mm-hmm.
Even we know in Western countries it's a big problem, but even Serbia is starting to have some lack of doctors in some areas, especially like usual pediatrics, mm-hmm. Radiology, anesthesiology. It's already not enough of them, with the perspective looking really bad.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like in every country.
Yeah, definitely.
It's getting worse. It's getting worse everywhere in Europe. So yeah, or in another way, better for young doctors that they
definitely because
depends how you look at it. For the state, it's gonna be a huge problem. Yeah. But for the young people finishing med school, they'll be able to probably choose what they wanna do and then immediately get paid.
Exactly. The prospect of having to work abroad in order to be financially independent is not a necessity anymore, because the same goes for Romania as well. The salaries are standard European salaries at the moment. So, yeah, fortunately, this changed. And how did your career go in Novo Nordisk from medical sales representative, from growth hormone, now to general manager? First you were general manager in Slovakia and now in Austria, so something must have happened in between.
Yes, there was a lot of in between. Actually, I was at this position where I started, medical sales representative for growth hormone, about a couple of years, and then I changed the positions every 2 years in Serbia. I changed actually four positions and going to different department, then larger department, smaller department. So kind of responsibility was increasing, also being responsible for some people, becoming a people manager.
Mm-hmm.
And until I
so
kind
you mean
of
human resource
no having like a business unit, which means like 10-15 people report to you, sales, marketing, medical, all kinds of, you know, so going up the ladder, the corporate ladder, as they say. And then once I kind of reached the second ranked position in Serbia below the general manager, it was time for next step. This was 8 years after I started. Mm-hmm. And then the opportunity was open in Slovakia, in Bratislava. So they asked me to take that job. And that was my first general manager job, which was in 2016. So some eight years ago, I went there and I spent 7 nice years there. And now for the past year, I am general manager of Novo Nordisk in Austria.
And it's, I think, a bit uncommon, for at least my experience with the pharmaceutical sector, that you stayed for so long in one firm, because I know a lot of people who changed firms and so on. Why this fidelity?
Well, in Novo Nordisk... It's not so uncommon, first of all. So Novo Nordisk is one of the companies where also here in Austria we have people who are with Novo Nordisk even longer than I am. I'm kind of usually the, as you say, like 17 now years in one company. It's strange. But I even have colleagues who are with Novo Nordisk 35 years. And then a lot of colleagues between me and this person. So a lot of seniority there. So for Novo, this is not so uncommon. But for me personally, this was also kind of, I would say, the coincidence that I always had, I relatively quickly changed roles. There was always an opportunity for me. They offered me nice positions that I couldn't not accept.
We will make you an offer. You can't refuse.
Exactly. So then kind of the company takes care of you, makes you feel safe, nice, and then you just stay there. I mean, people don't change jobs because just like that, they wake up one day. A lot of things needs to happen to push the person to change the job. And I never came close to that in my company.
But this is, of course, this is a very nice thing that you say about corporate culture, because I think in the media, corporate culture is always negatively presented, like, you know, they drain you and so on and the workload and etc. And what I hear from you is from the totally different perspective of a company that is actually very employer friendly and challenging and so on. So that's a very, I think, positive aspect that is worthy of mentioning, right? And how does, what does a general manager do? What's your job description, or what's the standard day in your job?
Yeah, where people might think, you know, that the general manager is the busiest person in the world and has, I don't know, to do a lot of operational stuff. But actually, general manager overlooks everything, is responsible in a way for everything. But operationally, it's very limited, the job you do, you know, it's because there are departments for everything. Where you, if you have good people and taking care of that, and then good people below them who also do their job, then your job is easier. When things are not going well, of course, then the job is tougher, because then you need to interfere more, figure out what's not wrong, and this is not easy, as they say. And you doctors who work with patients know that work with people is hardest work, because we are also people. We ourselves are sometimes difficult, sometimes less difficult. But the more people you have, the harder the work is. And you know, in pharmaceutical companies, there is quite a number of people. So it's more to kind of, I would say, it's closest to kind of some psychology, psychological work, knowing how to deal with people, what to say, what not to say, when to speak, when not to speak, how to treat everybody differently, because everybody is a different human being. So it's kind of a mix of that. And then also having this business understanding to know what's important and what's not in your business, and what will give results and what will not. So it's kind of more thinking, talking, listening, a lot of listening, rather than doing something with your hands every day on a computer or,
So planning, right? And of course, but what you describe, this is actually leadership. So how did you decide for yourself that leadership is something that you're good at? Because I think leadership is like, oh, you know, it's nice, and everybody's like thinking I'm a born leader, and then sometimes you just find out, well, that's nothing for me, let's say. How does somebody know if he or she is a good leader?
Yeah, this is a better scenario when the person which you described, that the person finds out, oh, maybe this is not for me. But I have met very few people. Usually it's the opposite. Oh, I'm a good leader, and actually the person is not. So then this overconfidence is happens more often than this self being self-critical. But actually, it depends a lot. You mentioned the corporate culture. It can happen that in one company, a person is a very good leader. Because the person is very good fit for the company. But in this, maybe in the same area, in the same, if you talk about another pharmaceutical company, maybe you might not be a good leader, because they expect something different. Let's say, imagine they expect more aggressive person, or more keen to look on the numbers, and not so much get involved with emotions of people, while in another company, it's more like this soft skills are needed. So when you ask me about me, you know, I mean, this leadership thing, it's kind of, it's never over, you know. You can never be like kind of the perfect leader. You always have to work on yourself. And when you, like, for example, me, when I come here and I get new employees, it's completely nothing that worked before. or everything that worked before might not work now, mm-hmm. or might even work against you. Mm-hmm. So that's why you always have to, you actually mentioned the most important part, be self-critical mm-hmm. and know yourself well. Mm-hmm. And then you might have a chance to do a good job. If you don't know yourself well, you cannot be a good leader. And mm-hmm. a good leader has to put people, I know it's a phrase everybody says, put people above you, but this is really what's very important. If you are looking, if your ego requires a huge space, then you have no chance.
For two offices.
Yeah. Then you have no chance to be a successful leader, because ego is this beast that requires a lot of food and can never be fed enough. So mm-hmm. yeah, a good leader has to really have control of her or his ego. Yeah,
mm-hmm. You mentioned knowing yourself. And what I brought for this episode is the questionnaire of Marcel Proust. Because I thought, well, you get asked these things a lot. So yeah, maybe try to get you out of the comfort zone.
Yes.
So, but I won't go every question through it, but I looked for a few questions. And one question is what is your Lieblingsbeschäftigung? So your favorite occupation?
My favorite occupation is coach of American football. That would be my dream job. I'm temporarily in this life. Because it's probably too late. It's definitely too late to do it this life, but we'll see what will happen next time around.
How did you get into American football?
I used to play a little bit of it in Canada. Mm-hmm. And then when I started studying medical school in Serbia and we were hanging out with friends, I brought this ball back, you know, this ball, it's like an egg. And one of my friends saw it in my room and said, what kind mm-hmm. of a ball is this? Because mm-hmm. in Serbia, everybody plays basketball or...
Normal soccer.
Or normal football, yeah, soccer. Yeah. And I said, can you show me how to throw it? Because mm-hmm. you have to throw it specifically mm-hmm. so that it spins properly. And then we went outside and then two more friends mm-hmm. came. And that's how actually we founded the first club. Two plus two plus four, then 8, 16. And then there were like 30 of us. Mm-hmm. In parallel, some other clubs were formed, and we founded kind of the first clubs in sport in Serbia beginning of 2000s, mm-hmm. and then it became a league, and now it's still alive. I am for like 15 or more years out of it, but people are still doing that, and I really enjoyed it. It helped me a lot also in my career.
Why?
Learnings from there. I give you one simple example. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, I work... in a company which has systems, people are very well educated. They know what to do. They come. They either did this job before. Or they know. We have also nice office, mm-hmm. computers, and everything. And there, you have nothing. You come. When I was a coach, first I was a player, then a kind of a player coach, and then mm-hmm. just a coach. Mm-hmm. You're a coach. 45 young men mm-hmm. come at 6 o'clock for practice. Mm-hmm. They line up and they wait for you mm-hmm. to tell them what to do. Mm-hmm. And these are, first of all, not disciplined men. They are young men. They are, one is crazy, one is smart, one is,
lazy,
one is aggressive, one is introvert, depressed. Mm-hmm. So you have all complete range of different people. Mm-hmm. And you have to organize well so that you will use this hour or 2 hours for practice mm-hmm. in the most efficient way, because you have to play a game. Mm-hmm. Time is going by if mm-hmm. you don't get mm-hmm. ready. And that's where I kind of excel this organizational skill. So then after that, you know, when you kind of have to do the general manager job, it's much easier.
But what makes American football different than, let's say, soccer?
Usually they compare it to rugby.
Okay.
Rugby. Mm-hmm. American football is this what you see with these pads and helmets mm-hmm, yeah. and they're hitting each yeah. other, and it's
the
actually
boyfriend yeah. of Taylor Swift, right?
Yeah. So they are extremely popular. It is extremely popular only in US, but it's played also mm-hmm. Austria, for example, very good on
yes,
European level.
I have a few patients who have kids in American football, and I know a lot of colleagues of mine always watch the Super Bowl. So it's quite popular.
Yeah, Vienna Vikings are, for example, here one of the best clubs in Europe. Mm-hmm. We used to come often to Austria to play because Serbia is also, over the years, we became quite good in this sport. So our clubs played. We also, I was the one of the first times I was in Austria was 2007 when I was the head coach of Serbia national team. And we played Austria here in Vienna. So,
and but you didn't answer the question. So what makes it special?
American football? Mm-hmm. Well, it's a very dynamic sport. Mm-hmm. You have to make decisions instantly, and these decisions you see immediately in the next play. And the plays last very short. It's like 5 seconds, and then you reconvene, and then next play, and then next play. So it's not like soccer or football. It's 90 minutes, and it's going, or, you know. Here, you know, every play, you have a chance to change. So it's a big influence of coaching. They say they call it like kind of the coachy sport. Some sports like football, if you have like, you know, Ronaldo, it's he will score goals by himself. But American football, a coach is able to have a really, really big impact.
So that leads me to my next question from the Proust questionnaire, because that's the question is, who are the heroes? Whom do you see as the heroes in real life? Are these the coaches?
Well, I wouldn't say the coaches are the heroes in real life. I see the heroes in real life are doctors, firemen,
nurses,
policemen. You know, so people who kind of protect the society and who work hard, difficult jobs, who even like firemen, they put their life online for somebody else. Doctors, when there was COVID, it was clear. COVID was a good test for the society, and maybe COVID answered this question for all of us, you know, who was at the front line when things got bad, you know.
Exactly.
A lot of people went to sit at home and do home office and click on their computer. But the doctor had to put this suit on with a mask and go to COVID hospital, you know.
Yeah, definitely. How did the pandemic affect the pharmaceutical industry? And I don't mean this in a way for Pfizer or vaccine development, but what did it do for the industry?
Not much. It impacted not just pharmaceutical, but all industries in these ways people work. So before COVID, this first
office
online
life.
Tools and stuff was not so much developed. Today, it's very advanced. So that means that a lot of people can do their job from home or remotely. People don't need to travel all the time to see each other. They can do virtual calls. So more in these ways of working. But other than that, I would say the impact was minimal. It's like back to pre-COVID. Everything else.
And now when I think about, you know, COVID and what also COVID unmasked, because we cannot go past this, is that also I think what became obvious was the obesity issue. Because before COVID, it was a lot of discussion. Then with COVID came the home office, the lockdowns, and so on, and also the new advent of obesity drugs. So since you come from Novo Nordisk, the obesity question is inevitable, let's say. What's your take on the issue? Because I read an interview with you in the magazine Profil, and it made me think about it, because you said for years or something, nobody would think that there would be a medical solution for obesity or something. Yeah. So what was your What was your take on it? Because Novo Nordisk is such a big company and mainly the diabetes company and with some rare disease. And it's like, for me, the impression is that obesity came in your lap, let's say, unexpectedly or not even wanting to have this gift, let's say.
Yeah. Well, the research was quite extensive for, I would say, more than 25 years in obesity area. But the breakthrough happened with GLP-1 molecules, which you know very well about.
So these are satiety hormones that are called a game changer in medical treatment of obesity. Mm-hmm.
So these drugs were, as you know, initially used for treatment of diabetes. Mm-hmm. However, they showed that you can also lose weight.
Mm-hmm.
And then further tests proved that also when used in people who don't have mm-hmm. diabetes but are just obese, mm-hmm. that the effect is there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So then that's how we had like the first serious...
Of trials.
Yes, mm-hmm. first mm-hmm. serious obesity, anti-obesity medication.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, this, you now ask a difficult question, but...
I know.
Yeah. COVID combined with obesity, I think generally people, what COVID changed, and now I'm not mm-hmm. talking about pharmaceutical, but in general, I think people started to respect life more
mm-hmm.
and to value more health and mm-hmm. to value more well-being in a way. Also, I mean, people are not willing to go to office if they have to commute 3 hours per day or if they can do all of their work at home. They want to stay at home. Also, mm-hmm. people are more aware about exercise, about well-being. However, the numbers show that intervention is needed because obesity is just the whole obesity pandemic is just getting worse and worse everywhere.
It really affects. Let's say a lot of people and mainly focusing on prevention or mainly showing oh it's such a big problem and putting the onus on the individual without having any sort of solution. I always tell my patients we don't study medicine for 6 years and then just say, you know, just move more and eat less. So it's very nice to have a drug. Or more drugs, actually, as a treatment alternative. But I think the image is a bit different because when you have a new cancer drug, it's always the story of hope and everybody is being very positive about it. When you have obesity drugs, I think maybe 2/3 of society are very incredulous or are very, oh, let's see what the side effects are, or oh, don't go there and it will be disastrous and so on. That maybe has to do with stigmatization of the disease as well. So I don't know, why aren't obesity drugs celebrated like new cancer drugs?
They are not, my opinion is because the whole disease development is at the very beginnings,
mm-hmm.
even though it has been like 20 years of research. And mm-hmm. you might remember there were molecules available 15, 20 years ago, which then were withdrawn from the market
exactly.
and so on. So initially bad experiences. So then everybody went even further back
mm-hmm.
that
mm-hmm.
this will not be possible. And I, when I talk to older colleagues in Novo Nordisk, they reminded me actually of which I was not aware because I was not around how the whole diabetes disease development went.
Mm-hmm.
Diabetes type 1 was not treated at all
mm-hmm.
30, 40 years ago. It was only type 1 which was receiving insulin treatment. So diabetes type 2. Was not treated, and slowly with the change of guidelines, in the 90s, people started to take metformin and then sulfonylureas and then so on. And then only years and decades after type 1 was already treated, clinical trials and guidelines show that insulin might be a good option for also type 2 patients, which is today a standard of care.
Yeah, but now with the avenue of new drugs like GLP-1 receptor agonist, SGLT2 inhibitors, then maybe insulin, you get past that. But I understand this.
It will be postponed or maybe avoided. It depends now on what will happen with the blood sugar level and so on, not to get into details, but you know, this was just type 2 was kind of not considered as a disease that required these kinds of intensive treatment. Same is now for obesity. We are kind of at this stage where slowly the society is starting to recognize that this eat less, work out more, or will not work. Because it's just getting worse and worse. And
it didn't work before.
It never worked, but you know, people just thought it will start working and it's not working. It's not working. So, definitely. I always ask when somebody says, but why doesn't it? I said, okay, just each of us can now think of all the people we have met and then try to then just roughly in your head think about obese people. Each of us has at least 10, 20, 100 people that are around us that are obese. How many of them have been able to lose weight by eating less, walking more, and keep it off for 5, 10, 15 years? I know zero. Somebody knows one person, which is really an exception or so on. And then you have 10, 20, 30, 100 examples of they lost 2 kilos, gained 3, lost 5, gained 10. So it just, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. Definitely. It's simple as that.
And now Novo Nordisk is expanding a lot. I just read an article that compared because of the growing obesity field, they and the meaning of Novo Nordisk for the Danish economy, for instance, they compared it a bit to Nokia in Finland. What's your take on that? Well, if because once Nokia was outlived, let's say, that really hit the Finnish economy quite badly. Is there a risk for obesity treatment to have this sort of backlash on Danish economy?
Yeah, hopefully we don't finish like Nokia. This is first thing I would like to avoid, that my company avoids that. That's why you need to have constantly innovation and never kind of relax that the game is over. Actually, in business, game is never over. Like in life, it can always be better and
learn
mm-hmm. and even when you think you have a good pipeline, it's still not enough. And from what we see now, the company really has invested a lot in research, now also in production for all these products. So hopefully we have what it takes for the future, to not have followed the Nokia example, which at one moment everybody had this Nokia 3310 phone, and now nobody has their phone. So hopefully Novo Nordisk knows what it takes to not end up there.
I think this field is very novel for everybody. Like with insulin and type 2 diabetes, so the bottom line is to help as many people as possible. And also I think and this is another question I find difficult from a company perspective. If I would put myself, let's say, in your shoes, you know, we saw in the pandemic what happened to vaccine prioritization, that governments were trying to acquire vaccines for their country and the competition that was, and then the discussion with the global north and the global south. And with obesity treatment, it's completely different, because so a lot of people have the impression that governments don't really care. There is no run from governments to pharmaceutical companies, although the necessity or the demand of people is very great. Is there some sort of, I don't know, gradient between, let's say, countries that are more interesting versus second world countries in matter of drug availability?
Well, I think the answer here is quite similar to the whole, like I said slightly before, the game is just at the beginning. Mm-hmm. The obesity game is just at the beginning. It's also at the beginning for governments. Mm-hmm. Governments, most of the governments, almost all of them, are still not aware of the scale and that obesity has become so big, and mm-hmm. it's getting bigger and bigger, and the situation is really getting worse every year, that it will not be sustainable. However, you know, like with everything, a game has to evolve enough that people will start to realize. The governments which are more progressive will mm-hmm. probably realize that sooner. Mm-hmm. The ones which are not so progressive, mm-hmm. they will be late. Mm-hmm. Of course, when you're late, then you have to pay the price mm-hmm. in a way. So, yeah, we just have to hope that the countries where we live in, at least, mm-hmm. will recognize it sooner mm-hmm. than the others. And it's going to be, I think, at one moment, the game will become like a competition, like it was in COVID, competition mm-hmm. between countries mm-hmm. for products. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. In a way, hopefully also we can do our job, not mm-hmm. just us but also the competitors. This is kind of a strange situation that we welcome as much as competition as possible, because the market is so huge. So hopefully we can expand our production, competitors mm-hmm. do the same, and that we together in joint effort with governments and solve at least part of the problem, you know. But how this will evolve, as it's at the beginning, mm-hmm. nobody knows. So it's still
there is too a lot of learning to do. I'm jumping back to Proust now. If there would be a natural gift, a natural talent, what sort of gift would you like to have?
I would have liked to be quicker on my feet.
To run.
To be quicker and more agile on my feet, because then I would have been able to play sports on probably professional level, which I was not able to. I was average, I would say a little bit above average in some mm-hmm. sports, mm-hmm. but not enough to earn money and earn a living for that. And I would have liked to be a sports player and have this career. Mm-hmm. It's good. Then I come back to this knowing yourself. Mm-hmm. It's important to realize and be objective. It's kind of some teenage age. I mean, you're not going to live from basketball, American football or anything. So then go to the hardest university and study.
If you're not Ronaldo,
and exactly, right? Mm-hmm. Exactly, and do some job that's.
Mm-hmm. What was a personal experience that taught you about leadership?
Most experiences I have from leadership are from my early career days. When I really have had an amazing leader who was the general manager in Serbia. He's now retired, and he actually picked me personally out, even when I was only 1 or 2 years in the company, when mm-hmm. I was in this beginner role. And he told me kind of, he saw something in me that I didn't see. Mm-hmm. And he says, stick around, because I had offers to also go to headquarters mm-hmm. for some nice positions early in the career. And he says, no, don't go, stay here with me. I will make you a successful general manager for the future. I was like, what are you talking about? Like, I'm just at the beginning. It's so far away that you don't, you cannot even foresee. But then you have the leader who sees for you. And I had also very similar situation at home with my father, who also saw things for me when I couldn't see them. And one of these was to go back to Serbia from Canada and then study medical school, because, you know, as a teenager, I was already in Canada, I had some friends, so I was, oh, should I go, should I not go, you know, this indecisiveness. And then he kind of decided for me, which people generally think, oh, but this is not good leader. No, when somebody decides for you. A leader knows when also he or she should step in and even decide for the person and the long-term help the person. So I had this kind of, I was lucky to early in my life to have a role model in the father as a good leader. And then also lucky, I mean, when you get in as a young person at work, if you have a good boss, then your career can take a different trajectory than than when you have a bad leader managing you, because then you don't know what good looks like.
But leaders also have to make tough decisions that affect one person or maybe 100 people, also like letting people go. And I think with The Apprentice and You're Fired and popular culture, this was somehow maybe glamorized, but it's a very bad, or it's a very hard thing, it's a very difficult thing to fire people if you're not inclined from your personality. Is there any sort of training for that, or how do you manage also the negative sides of the job when it's about decisions that affect people's lives?
Exactly. You now touch the probably hardest skill that a leader or a manager should have, because going through a career managing big companies or a lot of people, it cannot happen that you go through a whole career, you retire, and you haven't fired anybody. So it will have to come sooner or later. So the sooner you kind of learn this skill, the better. The problem with this is that nobody teaches this. There are also very few books, and it's kind of considered, I mean, just sit with a person and just fire them. And this is completely strange. And that's why I have started in my own teaching journey, because I'm teaching in one MBA program. For a couple of years, I have a really special and long session on letting people go, on firing people, how to do it decently, properly, how to try to kind of minimally hurt people's feelings, how to protect yourself also as the one firing from a psychological impact, and so on. So it's kind of a really deep topic. I'm trying to at least spread some knowledge, because unfortunately, I had to do it quite a lot also, especially in Slovakia, in my it was kind of requested by the company, so I had to do it. And I went through it the hard way and then learned what works, what doesn't work. And then it's a really, really tough thing to do, and you never get used to it. You always feel bad. However, at least you can learn the skills to do it properly. You know, and also very few people do it properly. That's why it usually ends up bad. And what's really strange is when you look at what events in our life have most psychological impact, number one by far is death of a close family member. Number two is divorce. Number three is getting fired. And the first two, everybody talks about, everybody, you know, has opinion. Number three, it's considered, you know, just sit down and let the person go and it's done, you know. It's not done. If you approach it like that, there will be trouble, you know. So that's why I never took it easy. You never want to do it. But sometimes it just, it has to be done.
And how do you do it nicely?
To do it nicely, it's first of all, really getting into the shoes of the other person,
mm-hmm.
really showing empathy,
mm-hmm.
a lot of empathy. And this is number one. So showing a lot of empathy mm-hmm. and really putting yourself in the shoes like you are getting fired.
Mm-hmm.
And this is seen in the conversation. If you mm-hmm. don't come out as, you know, jerk, mm-hmm. confident, who just wants to let somebody go, this mm-hmm. is first thing. And second thing is what I think people always appreciate is be direct from the start.
Mm-hmm.
So usually people say, oh, you're such so good and we like you and you did this good. And but.
Yeah.
So skip exactly. the first part because you are just getting on person's nerves and mm-hmm. there is no need. People are smart.
Mm-hmm.
People can take it.
Mm-hmm.
Just say it like it is. This is not the moment to lie and mm-hmm. for this bullshit talks and I don't know, mixed motivational talks with this. Oh, but don't worry, future has something for you. So just say what you have to do.
Mm-hmm.
If you need to sign the papers, get the paper signed, open up to the person and try to finish it for both parties in this occasion, want to get it over as soon as possible. So respect that and then the other person will respect you as well.
Mm-hmm. So be direct.
And if possible, if the company allows, be generous to the person mm-hmm. because this is a hard moment in mm-hmm. Financial terms, mm-hmm. But this mm-hmm. is then... it depends. Some companies can afford it, some cannot. Sometimes the company is in trouble, so mm-hmm. I have to let people go.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also about practicing now mm-hmm. all of this. We never practice. And people just sit down and then they're clumsy mm-hmm. and they... cannot say the words they plan. So, mm-hmm. you know, role play this, practice. If you want to be good mm-hmm. at your job, you have to practice. Like football players, they practice, and they play the game. They don't just go and play the game.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we go out and fire people, and we never, even in front of the mirror,
mm-hmm.
tried it out before, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. So this is
mm-hmm. yeah,
what it takes.
But it's a very dignified thing, and even... The thing that it requires preparation makes it worthy, let's say. That's the last thing I wanted to ask you, because you mentioned that you do also teaching and of course you're a coach and you like to do teaching. What do you like best about teaching?
Well, now since I'm out of this sports coaching, I'm mm-hmm. not doing sports coaching.
No,
I'm not doing that for 15 years.
Okay.
I used to do that.
Okay, but yeah. Why not?
I don't just have time for it, and okay. I never did it since I went since I left Serbia.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not compatible with the full time job and the family and all of that. Since sports, for example, even when I was in Serbia,
mm-hmm.
it became much more serious that it required almost a full time job being a coach. You know, then I would have to choose either quit my
job
and do something I also love, which mm-hmm. is coaching, but
mm-hmm.
Not paid or mm-hmm. yeah, you know, so it wasn't a real job, but it required the effort of a real job.
But you are a family man, you are a yeah. father, a husband. How do you make it work, this so-called work-life balance? Because, yeah. I mean, work is part of life, so
yeah.
you just don't live for 8 hours less, let's say. But how do you integrate family life, which is also a full-time job?
It's also a full-time job. As they say, it's easy to balance work and life when there is not one or the other, you know. But when you have both, then mm-hmm. the balancing becomes tricky. Well, for me, family is number one.
Mm-hmm.
Family is number one, definitely about work and everything else. So, and you always, if family is important to the person, it has to be clear in the decisions you make. You know, we can also sometimes slow down the career
mm-hmm.
or maybe not take the next step if you see that might hurt your family life. And I was never ready to jeopardize anything happening to my family mm-hmm. because of work. Even though, you know, I took decisions and we moved together from our country and now I have another job. And, you know, But I always do it to make sure that I keep
that it fits.
This balance. Of course, it's up and down. Sometimes you're 50-50 balance. Mm-hmm, sometimes mm-hmm. you're 60-40, 40-60. Mm-hmm. But on the long run, it should be evened out. And then you put other things down. You know, unfortunately, I had to give up. I was meeting my. When I lived in Serbia, I had a lot of friends and I spent a lot of time there. I did coaching of American football. So these two kind of had to go. And then the rest of the time is split now solely between my closest family, son and wife, and my work. And that's more or less it. You know.
Does your son like football?
He likes this normal football now. He's nine.
Is this hard for you?
He's nine. No, it's still fine. I'm just a kind of, for me, it was important that he gets into sports, mm-hmm. any kind of sport. And mm-hmm. I really don't care if it's going to be basketball, football, tennis, mm-hmm. American football. Mm-hmm. He should do whatever he likes. Of course, football is most popular. So mm-hmm. that is why him and most kids are first. As first sport, attracted.
Even my daughter likes soccer.
So. Exactly. I was also, I didn't start with American mm-hmm. football. I also started with tennis and football and basketball. As you grow older,
Serbia,
you also change.
Tennis is mandatory. Yes. It's like the national sport, right?
Yes, now it is,
Right. So, what do you like best about teaching?
About teaching, back to that, it's that I kind of relive my coaching mm-hmm. Coaching sports life mm-hmm. through that, but on a different level. I actually do help people, as I mentioned, hiring mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. recruiting mm-hmm. good people mm-hmm. or making a good team, and because I teach leadership, mm-hmm. people and talent development, so the topics I actually love the most during my work, and that's where I acquire most of the experience, and that's mm-hmm. what I teach. And now I get to also share it with some younger people who might then have it easier, at least a little bit in life. But mm-hmm. with most of the things, you kind of have to break the wall with your own head, but at least you can have need to do it all the time. So if you pick up some tricks from the older people,
this stands out. I think we are so, let's say, successful maybe as a species because we teach each other stuff. Alexander, thank you very much for talking to me on the podcast, and it was very insightful. I hope that the questions were not too lame, let's say, what you hear all the time. We wish you that you maybe find a new American football team, maybe. We're rooting for you. Thank you for being so honest and open. I really enjoyed talking to you a lot. And thank you all for listening, and also tune in next week with our new episode. And until then, schöne Grüße.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure to be here today.